Thank you for joining us for episode number 44 of The Voices of Boyle. This week, I'm joined by Tom Mullaney. Tom takes us on a journey through his life, spanning from his school days where he recalls the rare but stern discipline of the past, to his 38-year career in the National Bank. Tom also chats about the agricultural landscape of Ireland, highlighting his own experiences with farming, the EU's impact, and the potential shifts in trade. He speaks about his involvement with the County Board for GAA, and his deep-rooted passion for preserving and enhancing Boyle's heritage. We explore the town's potential for redevelopment, reflecting on its historical prominence and how it can be revitalised for a brighter future. Plus, we get to hear Tom's advice to his younger self and his journey in Irish politics. So I hope you have a great Sunday and enjoy this episode. Tom, thank you very much for joining us here on The Voices of Boyle. Hope you're keeping well today.
Hi, thank you very much for having me, Carlo.
No problem at all.
Looking forward to
Getting into it.
Yes.
Tom, you're not a Boyle man originally, are you?
No, not that would be like a politician. There's two answers to that question. I was actually born in the town, but it was in the nursing home. There was a nursing home beside where Brogans is. Nurse O'Brien and Nurse Hannon were there. But I'm born in a place called Fass in Crahan. And that's where my father came from. He came from Cape Town, but he was living there. And my mother was Bridget Tolan from Braindrum and Boyle. So I'm a Boyle man, except when Shannon Gales are playing.
And then you're out to Crahan.
Yeah. So that's sort of the general family background. Like most of my Mullaney side of the family are in Crahan, across that area, across to French Park and down near Boyle. And my mother's side are Boyle with South Sligo. So the barony of Boyle would cover my background. And okay. I've stretched to all corners of that.
Right. I didn't know there was a nursery there beside Brogans.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So was that where the post office is now, or is
no,
it between?
No, it's on the other side. It was where the opticians was initially, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Perfect. So you went to school in Crahan.
Crahan, yeah.
And what was it like in those days?
Well, it was the old building. It was in its last year, and it was an unusual year because it was only afterwards people said, oh, there was a strike. We had about five or six different teachers in that year. Now, maybe it had something to do with the condition of the building or whatever. And sometimes the senior pupils took the class. And I remember upstairs, there was mouse traps in place to how to catch unwanted visitors. And they had the turf fire. And of course, everyone was supposed to bring their load of turf to heat the school. And some came earlier than others, and it had come to the end of the year and the new turf would be brought, and there was more smoke than fire out of that as the steam rose. So, but it was, and we were just a year in that, and then we went into the new school in 55. And now we have a third school in Crahan in my lifetime, like, you know. Mrs. Fay was a teacher, Danny Morton, and then Master Callahan, who was, I would say, the man I remember best from school, because he was an unbelievable teacher. Like, when we left Crahan National School, we were fit. Well, you were almost fit for the immigrant ship if you were going that way, because you had up to intercert, all the work was already done. And I moved on then, stayed in the parish of Crahan, and I moved on to what was called Mrs. Lynch's officially Rosary High School. And in recent days, we had Mrs. Lynch's grandson was buried in Kerry Kinshannon there a week ago, Michael Lynch, and his father, Michael, taught me, and of course, his grandmother, Mary Kathleen Lynch. Unusual at the time that it was co-ed, as it were. It was a mixed boys and girls school, mainly country pupils, not so many from the town of Carrick, but the out. So I was exposed to elites from experience at that stage, and I have had exchange with that many, many times over the years. A lot of us came in from Crahan. apart from the lessons, I suppose the prime subject was the football. And we did have a fairly good, for a small school, we did a fairly good tussle. So with St. Mary's in Boyle, Roscommon CBS, and we beat a couple of times for county colleges championships. Not that I was much of a footballer, but enthusiasm can get you everywhere.
Oh, can indeed. Yeah. Yeah.
So they set me up for life, and it followed on my career. And this, they had an unusual thing is at the time too, they had guidance counselling. The past pupils used to bring us in to the county hotel at the time, and they talk about their jobs, five or six different jobs, for to give people a help. And the Lynch family followed through, and like I had never stood in a Northern Bank in my life, and they introduced me, and I ended up working for the Northern Bank, which opened up a whole new experience in terms of Ireland and the question of it, north and south. And
yeah. So the Northern Bank was the national. Was
it became the national Irish as it went on, but it was in Boyle, and you know, there was different towns around that had Northern. Northern was one place and the Ulster were the other. And from the industrial base in Belfast, they came south, I'd say, for deposit gathering in the old days. And so I went into the Northern Bank, and that opened up a whole new world. I did make a choice at one stage about the guards and the bank that came the same week. And why did I choose one over the other? Well, I had a passing interest always in politics. And I says, well, if you have one uniform on you, can't put, if you have a blue uniform, you can't put a blue shirt on you. So it had a bearing on my thinking about it. But anyway, that was the way.
And obviously we're going to get into the politics in a while as well, because you've, as you said, you were very much involved in that through the years. Yeah. But just before we get into the bank, and then going back, so you went to school in the early days in Croaghan, and then you went to Carrick and Shannon.
Aye, to Rosary High School in Carrick and Shannon.
Okay, and how would your, I suppose, how would you sum up those school years? Were they good or bad?
They were good. I have to say my experience of school was good. National school, okay, there was a little bit of the rod, but generally it was good. And I'd say from an educational point of view, it was good as well. In Mrs. Lynch's, it was a whole new experience, a different one that would have been experienced to most people, because it was a family set up. We were given a hot tea or coffee at lunchtime in a basement. That was the routine. You didn't have cold lunch. School tours were organised, and she had done a special deal with that, and you'd go to a community hall. I remember going to Drogheda and went up the north, which was going to us about a foreign country, where you were seeing the RIC men or the RUC men with the revolvers on their hips and that. So it was a hands-on approach. So I would say, school-wise, I was pampered.
Yeah. And you mentioned there about a bit of the Al Rod.
Yes. So, that was only in, you know, the remember one time there was someone came to visit the school, and of course we were all creating a racket inside, and the master came in anyway, and he gave us all one. And that was the only time ever it happened.
Would you say there was a fear of, in those days especially, when it was more generally accepted to get a little flaking of the rod or the wooden spoon or whatever it was?
There was, I would say, in fairness to my school experiences, it wasn't an issue really. That was the only one occasion stands out. And I know there was the leather strap and whatever, but we didn't know. The teachers, I would say, were good. And then, you know, we walked to school. We cycled to school in Carrick and Shannon. There wasn't any, how would I call it, there wasn't luxury in them days.
No, that's
the
for
50s.
Sure.
Yeah. And you accepted what it was and grew up on a farm, and The rent collector was the serious man that called twice a year, and it was a heavy burden tax-wise, as
course,
it were.
Yeah.
But,
and in those days, Tom, as well, was there, back in, I think maybe your earlier days in school, milk bottles. Had you the milk bottles kind of warming by the fire?
Yeah,
yes.
And the Yorkshire relish and the ketchup bottles would be sitting on the range.
Yes, on the
and
range,
some
right.
of them be cracked and
yeah,
you know, with the heat, and you'd have a sandwich or whatever.
Yeah, that was one thing I always heard from the olden days as well. So obviously then. You got into the, you made the choice, instead of going to the garage, you went down.
I went to the bank.
To the bank. And can you just talk maybe about your journey and experiences working in the National Bank for, was it 30, 40 years?
I was 38 years.
38 years, right.
I went in 68. Did the exam in Belfast. And that again was a strange experience. And myself and a lad who died recently became town clerk at Sligo, John McNavola. We both did the bank exam at the same time. And John was in Templemore. And I think that time, if you had a job, they gave it to the one who hadn't a job. Now, before I went in to the bank, I did to what we call hard labour. I worked with the Land Commission fencing. I never was a man for hard labour, but that's what I'm calling it. And then I spent 6 months in Bordnamona in Mount Dillon in the work study before I actually went to the bank. So,
I mean, you would have seen a lot of change then in the banking system. Over those 4 decades.
Yes, and it was. Well, the biggest thing about the job and where I went and the bank I went with, I ended up in Rough Owen, County Donegal. And in line with what I said earlier, the PR referendum came up shortly after I went in, and I took an active part in that, despite being only 3 weeks in the bank. Not a wise decision, but anyway, Rafo was unusual, I suppose. It was very much a north of Ireland town, although it was in County Donegal. It was the cathedral town for the diocese, and you had the Church of Ireland cathedral, and you had various Presbyterian, Reformed, Methodist, Catholic, a mixed community that was working well and happy together. A very wealthy area, probably one of the best areas in East Donegal. And, of course, then we had the other experience of the apprentice boys who went into Derry on the 12th of August, and the Hibernians marched on the 15th of August. Now, I somehow used to say that they had the same instruments, but they were probably playing different tunes. But I really enjoyed Donegal, and the people were so friendly. Now, we would have seen Donegal people on the Bridge of Boyle when they came with the seed potatoes and the lorries, because, you know, tillage wasn't a high priority, certainly down in Crahan area. The men from the Corlews and that came in with their seed potatoes as well and round to the Shambles. But that would be our experience of the Donegal men first, and there I was working among them, and I had 3.5 happy years, I would say. I had that experience with Paddy Hart and going to meetings in different places. Went into Derry, missed the October 5 in Derry by accident. I was thumbing a lift. I got the lift that day to Letterkenny. I could have been in the middle of October 5 as I found myself when I went on a course to Belfast. There was a crowd rushing down the street, and I thought it was going for a train. They were, but it was a riot in 1917. That was one of the advantages, I would say, in my life to have been with an institution that had a north of Ireland and a south of Ireland base.
You got to experience both.
Aye. And I was wearing the pioneer pin, and I was walking up Sandy Row, and some missionary group passed me, and they said, "Oh, look at him! And they came and chatted me." You know, it was my naivety and foolishness, I suppose, but it was good to see Belfast. And when you talk in terms
back
of
in those days,
aye, and yeah. I, you know, it was just the troubled work. Oh, they were brewing. We ended up another night by accident in the Guildhall in Derry, innocently at a dance. But we discovered that it was for the Ibrox Park Disaster Fund, and it wasn't a place for a South of Ireland accident. As you would have been, the soccer men know the significance of that. And we came out of that alive.
And did you, so apart from, you worked in Donegal in the bank?
I worked in Donegal in the bank, and then I went to the bright lights of Grafton Street and the students coming out of Trinity College, walking up past Grafton Street and a whole. Now, in between that, of course, I interrupted it with the strike that lasted 6 months in 1970, and I went to Dublin that time. I worked in what was Kevin's, later became James's Hospital, the site of the would-be National Children's Hospital. Mm. I worked 6 months there, and I enjoyed that inside and outside with patients, and there was people there who had been through the War of Independence, who played with Kildare in the 20s.
And what was your role there? What were you?
I was an attendant. And the good part of it was that I was on £12 in the bank, and I was on 18 when I was on strike there.
It was worth your while.
Yes.
And so apart from Dublin, did you work anywhere else in the bank?
In Dublin, I spent from 71 to 77. I was in Dublin. I was as a relief staff, and I worked around the country in different towns. Terrams in Mohull, Cork, Limerick, Galway, various places like that. And then I spent 3 years in Grafton Street at this itself. And at that stage when I became, I suppose, because I was around the place, I was popular, but I was known. And there was an elections for union reps were severely fought, because we were in a union that was outside the Congress of Trade Unions, the Bank Officials Union, which was about the fifth biggest union in the country. And I ran for election in 75 for that mass vote. And I gathered all the cronies from Leitrim and Roscommon and everything. And I was on the National Executive for 3 years. And I became Assistant Secretary at national level of the IBOA. And during that time, we had another one of those unmentionables. I had, was it 3 or 9 week strike? I think we had a 9 week strike, yeah. The government passed legislation controlling our pay. And at one stage, we were all called in before the minister, full executive, and a law was passed controlling our pay in 1977. That time, inflation was rampant. Mm. These were words I knew nothing about. Inflation was blowing up a balloon to me before that, but the cost of living was rising at about 20% per annum. And, you know, the oil crisis from 73 had set in motion a whole price rises, and people just weren't able to keep up with it. And because of the legislation, I was one of four people who took a constitutional action against the government for controlling our salaries and costing us money for the rest of our service and various things. Like. Mm. Now, it petered out eventually because, you know, strike was settled and we went back to work, and you began to live with it again, you know?
Yeah. So your time in the bank, Tom, obviously it'd be overall a positive experience for you over those 38 years. Were there any negative sides to it that you can remember?
No, I suppose the thing about the bank was fairly regimental. Mm. A lot of rules based, and inspections were a regular feature. They walk in at 3 o'clock in the day to you, and you hadn't your books in order or your I's dotted and all T's crossed. And I'd often say to myself, we used to complain about that, and were I a mechanic, we'll say, and I was at an engine of a car, and if the piston was a couple of centimetres out, that wouldn't work. But in the bank, I felt that I should give myself that latitude that nearly would do the job. in 77, then I got, I was in Dublin, I was in the Union, I had been, and I was happy enough with the whole setup. And I was offered a promotion. Now, at the back of my mind, I always wanted to come back to the Savage Loves His Native Shore. I wanted to come back to Boyle and to move down to the bank. My mother, I remember a discussion, I said, wouldn't it be nice to go to Dowra or somewhere near you? Couldn't work in your own town.
Mm.
But
Dowra.
I was offered a promotion to come to Drumshambo as assistant manager, and I spent 10 good years there.
In Drumshambo?
In Drumshambo.
And you mentioned Dowra.
And Dowra, well, I Dowra came later.
You went to Dowra?
I went to Dowra eventually. Eventually.
Nice, okay.
Followed the money.
Go ahead, Tom.
So it was a fair... Then I was back again. I was on the National Executive in 87.
Okay.
Of course, all the while I was involved in the GAA at home, and I was chairman of the club in the 70s. And in the 80s, I was county board.
We're going to get into that for sure. Okay. Yeah, definitely. Just to finish off then on the banking, what do you think, as you've seen the way banking has migrated online now to basically there's not many physical stores or physical banks that you can go into these days. What's your view on that going from maybe analog days to everything now being online?
That is,
you know, maybe a lot of the older generation wouldn't be able to, they'd feel confident to access the facilities and services that they would need.
Yeah. Well, in fairness, I'd say here in Boyle, and I'd have to give great credit to Bank of Ireland and the staff there, and I came from a different, I did attempt to get into the Bank of Ireland, but they didn't let me in all those years ago. But the staff, and we have a service in Boyle where you can actually go in and talk to somebody if you have a little problem. But outside the bank altogether, last Sunday I was trying to get a ticket for the match, and I tried to get it online with Ticketmaster, and they wanted to sell me insurance, and they wanted to sell me different things to protect me.
What match was this now?
The Roscommon.
Oh, yes. It's all done online now, isn't it?
Online. You know, you can't even, I think you have to sneeze online nowadays.
You do.
And the farming thing. Now, that's the way at the present time. But I think there has to be a facility for people. And like, I'm somebody who's been handling computers all my life, and I have
a difficult
with it, and it can be frustrating. Not frustrating, it drives you. So you then have to sort of nearly employ professionals to do your day-to-day work for
you. You have to rely on a friend or a family member.
That's right.
And some people might feel they're bothering people if they do that.
Yeah.
But I think it was Gerry Emmett on his episode did talk about that you had to go online to get a ticket for the game matches now, which I think is crazy.
It is.
You'd have a lot of people, even in their 80s, that would still love to go. They're not going to be bothered about buying a ticket online.
No.
So they're going to be going down the route, you said, trying to find someone else to do it or employing someone to do it. Moving on then, you mentioned to me that you ran for the Shannon in 81
and 83, yeah.
Okay, and what was involved in that?
You had to get a nomination, first of all. Now, I would have been involved. I was involved in the general election of 81, and it was a bit of a panic, although it's all right for me to say that. In 1981, John Burke stood down as TD, and it was either 16 or 21 people contested. I used to know other names of contested the Fine Gael nomination. And I proposed Charlie Degnan at that stage. But because I was working with Northern Bank, I sort of persuaded them that the Shannon was a bit like the House of Lords. And it wasn't really a political, and it wasn't. It was, in theory, it's a vocational thing that you have labour panel, industrial and commercial, you have agriculture, you have education. There's five different panels, and it's on the basis of your knowledge. And the fact that I had indeed industrial relations input from being a member of a union involved and experience of that, I got a nomination. through the ICPSA to run on the Labour panel, now as distinct, not the Labour Party, but the Industrial Relations panel. And it meant going around the country, the whole, I was going to say 32, but we're not united yet, but 26 counties, and the county councillors, the sitting senators, TDs, all those fellows, all the hard-nosed professionals. And it wasn't good enough to write to them or send your card or whatever, and printed my canvas and card and I headed off. And I did a lot of the country. It was very little of it I didn't do. Now, I wasn't cured after one dose of that. I went at it again. I decided not to go in 83 because there was three elections in 18 months. And I said that each time a general election is called, there's a Shannon election immediately after it. So I ran. I didn't go the next time. I think if I had gone the second time in the middle one, I'd have got elected. But no one, things were so precarious, you'd be in and out. So I run the third time. And between the two elections, I got 40 votes, which was pretty big, you know, for these were councillors or across the country. Now the OGA and the thing and a bit of collegiality, and then maybe the fact that it was a bit of a no-ho for at times, they said, we'll give him a vote and we'll pass the preference to the another fella.
Okay.
So it was
an experience.
It was an experience.
And so I believe that the main function of the Shannon is to debate legislation that's proposed by the government.
That's right.
Can they amend a bill, but they can't stop it?
They can't stop it. They can amend it and they can refer it back. And eventually, I think after 3 months, the legislation can go through. But like a lot of things, there's a lot of tools and fraud. But that's the way our democracy functions. We have two houses. I suppose we hadn't, the House of Lords, a totally different thing in Britain as against the Shannon, they call it the upper house.
The upper house, yes. The lower house,
the
comma
is for the ordinaries.
Yeah.
And it was just an interest I always had. And I suppose I was brought up, my cousin of my father's, Jack Burton, who was connected to your family too, was a TD for Clanathalo and he won in six elections in Roscommon. So I was coming into that. It wasn't of the wind, I suppose. I took that interest, and
would you consider yourself then a Fine Gael supporter?
I have. Right. I've always been that. Now I'm getting more. I think we're in bed with Fianna Fáil, and I think we're sleeping happily together. We're totally asleep, but
yeah. Well, that whole kind of coalition government thing is kind of very mucky at the moment.
It is, but I was been thinking, and I said it to a Sinn Féin councillor 2 or 3 years ago. I said, you know, we're going to be into a national government. And like you see the North, for a different reason, they operate a government across the thing with two different parties. And if there's a stalemate after the next election, that you have three parties. I'm not saying that the others aren't entitled to it, but if it leads to stability and common sense, because people will highlight their differences, but we're basically most on the same page.
And what would be your views now, Leo?
Well, I would have been in favour of Leo as distinct, because I take the view Fine Gael is Conservative Party and we can have that any day of the week. I want some more middle-of-the-road person, and I thought Leo would bring that to it. I think he does too. He's almost unpolitical in the way he goes on. He's not afraid to put his foot in it, as it were, and that's, of course, for the zealots politically, that's an awful thing to do. And I think in the last couple of months, weeks or months, he has spoken out very strongly about the war in the Middle East. And, you know, we are a country that depends a lot on international investment. And there's a lot of influential people out there who mightn't fire a bullet at us or a bomb, but they could hit you economically. And I think it's shown bravery, and I think it's shown moral courage, because Europe, we're part of Europe, but we're not bought by anybody.
People would disagree with that in terms of that we're part of Europe, but people think we're also at the handcuffed to Brussels in certain economic ways.
We are economically, but I think we have, I said it to somebody, a friend of mine in Britain, and when they pulled out, I said, what did you run off like crybabies, as it were? In that sense, the fifth strongest country in the world, or economy, we'll give them credit for that anyway. And they go to Brussels and they come back and they say, oh, well, Cameron went over and he said, oh, he got rejected. He didn't listen to him. I said, we go over regularly.
Mm.
And sometimes we agree. And sometimes we disagree. But whatever we do, we come home. And by and large, we do our own thing. It may not seem like that. And there's pros and cons about, we were in an awful state at the time of the financial crisis. Now, it wasn't the Europeans that built all the houses.
No, that's for sure.
You know?
Yeah, that's for sure.
And that borrowed and did all that. And it's obviously made people have, everyone has their own view about it. We were 60 billion. We hear about 60 billion that we bailed out the banks, and various things happened. And there are people who suffered, and I'm not excluding myself from that. But we did what every customer should do. He should never break his bank manager's heart by saying, I won't, and I definitely won't. I say, be positive and say, I look after you. And that's what we've done. And if you take a very simple, statistic, we went from 4% unemployment up to 15, and we went back down again to 4. And we became, people were continuing to give us money. Okay, there was twitches here and there, and I'm saying I know what it's like today dealing with vulture funds, personal experience of that. It's a war, you have to fight your way through it. And I think, on balance, we keep our independence, but we also are being prepared to be, we'll put on the jersey. We mightn't always play with the team.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
And going back to what you said about the bailouts and the investments, do you remember a couple of years ago, Apple were the 40 billion that we basically refused to take off them, on the premise that we won't take your money as long as you keep your business on these shores. Now, a lot of people would have been up in arms over that. What would your view be on that, Tom?
Well, it was 13 or 14 billion, but it was anyway the sum.
Sorry,
We moved, that was the bridge, the biggest bridge that was built in the world was the one when we moved from millions to billions. It was only a letter in the alphabet, but it was quite a
significant
swing. And we spoke a totally different language. Europe, you see, this is where we were. Who were we disobeying? We were acting in our own interest. And although Europe was the big boy and we are supposedly compliant, we said no, because they wanted us to collect the money off Google and Apple or whoever it was and pass it on to them. You know, that wasn't money that was coming. We were going to divvy it out among them. And this is why we never will say we're bad boys or yellow card or red card fellas on the team. But we do things, we have an independence. And that's why I come back to the war in Israel and different things that, we certainly shouldn't be patting ourselves on the back. But we do, externally, people see what we're about and we have to be reckoned with.
So in that instance then, we refused to take the Apple's, in this instance, their money to pass it on to EU.
You.
In the promise that they would stay in Ireland and keep their employment for those industries.
Yes, well, we had set up whatever our apparatus now, and they are very grey areas. You know, Europe adjudicates, if you're apart from the country altogether, you could be a farmer. And if you cut the rushes too close to the drain, you lose your money. No one talks about that poor fella, and it's serious big important to him. There's those kind of things that Europe do, and they're very pedantic. But we're very Irish when it comes to those situations. And we can act independently. And it wasn't at last to our... There was a bigger stake to, and you can see now the 13 billion, it pales in comparison. There's years that we actually took 13 billion in corporation tax, and they're hounding us on that as well. So it's complex. You can say on ideological grounds, oh, you're terrible. But, you know, you have referees in every match, and the reason for that is that everyone commits an odd foul to make sure they win the game.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And that summed it up. You mentioned there earlier, we said we'd get back to it, about the, you were involved with the county board for
yes.
GAA.
Yeah.
What year was that in?
Well, I got in 83, I became part of the Centenary Committee. And celebrating 1884, and we at that time we had still 12 members of the team that won the All Ireland in 1944 alive, and all the events organised about that in the county, and then I moved from that into the history committee, and
well, you were involved in some
the history of the county board, and I collaborated with Tony Conboy
yeah.
At that, there was a committee of four or five, but like that, these committees, there's working committees and there's talking committees, and it was a thing that had gone on, and eventually with Tony writing and me reading,
you got through it.
We got through it in 1990, and like it stands as a, it was does, an outstanding.
It was recently republished again.
Republished
wasn't it?
Again, yeah. Yeah, it's even sought after. You know, it is sought after, although yes. It's only comes forward to 1990. So,
and you did some writing as well on the Crahan.
I did. I did the Shannon Gales history in 1985. And it wasn't just the Shannon Gales. We did the records of, I put in the Griffiths valuations for the thing, went by the survey and distribution of 1649. There was various bits in it that were wider than the GA and what was going on in the time of the founding of the Land War. And, you know, a lot of the GA itself would have come out of the National League and the Land League, in the late 1880s, and then poor old Parnell, you know, a man we think Parnell was never lived. We talk about great historic figures like, I don't know why we forget about, ask anyone, Henry Grattan, Daniel O'Connell, Parnell, Michael Davitt. They are men that, and I'd say of them all, Michael Davitt was the man that won the freedom for the ordinary people. He put them in possession of their lands, and Davitt or Parnell in Parliament got the acts, the Land Acts in the 1880s, and that continued right through with the Land Commission right up until the 1960s. And when I think of coming from Crahan to Boyle, there was probably four or five farms in total between Crahan and Boyle four or five farmers that owned the whole lot. There was three on the plains. You had Mylorg, and then you had Rockingham. And look today, you have had people whose grandfathers and great-grandfathers were shifted off the plains and sent to the Curlews, or in our case, pushed up to Crahan. And, you know, maybe we went for good reason, because there was no shelter on the plains and there was no water on the plains in the summertime. But that wasn't the reason they wanted us that land. And that land now has all gone back into the hands of, in small parcels and bigger parcels, to the local people. Mm. And the Land Acts did that.
I would have had some recollection of those names and the Land League and that from my history days with Tony Conboy in school. But when you were researching those books back in 85, I think, and 1990, obviously we take everything for granted now when it comes to research. We have the internet. Yeah. What was your medium and what was your kind of, was it talking to people? Was it going back through books and, you know, what was the...
And I was, of course, I double-jobbed anywhere I was. I was on the executive of the in the union, and I was going to Dublin. And I was going to Belfast regularly, like industrial meetings in Belfast too. So we're going in and out of Belfast and the bombs and that carry-on was gone. But the National Library... I did the research in the National Library and you were reading microfilm of handwritten documents and printed stuff like that. And I'd spend the evening after the meeting, I'd go in there maybe at 5 o'clock and it's been 3 hours and going through that. And
writing
in my case, I was the worst writer that ever went through Crahan School.
And it's a painstakingly slow process well. So
So it was that, and I suppose I always had an interest, like men like John Kinney, who had played in 1903 with Roscommon, and I was always engaging with those people way before the use of reason, as it were. So I would have had a feel for it. And then you see around where I grew up, and that's why the certain things influence you. Our house was a rambling house. Card players come in.
Storytelling.
And we'd be upstairs listening to the going on and fellas battering tables and fighting over a trick in 1925. And Tommy Kinney, Paddy Travers were either side of us, and they were big GA men. And then, of course, Dickie Vernon was beside us, and Hartsfield, the football was going on there. And you see, Dickie played in the 62 All-Ireland. You had these people who subconsciously influenced you. So that was... things don't happen by accident. You're led astray by those whom you meet along
the
way.
That's true, yeah. And I think you mentioned that you were into farming.
That was I would recall that. That's
an interest.
Like Harry Worth, that's a joke. But anyway, I hope no one from Crahan is listening, because they say, I am into farming, like I'm into everything else.
Would you have your own land?
I have cattle. And okay. My brother in Crahan, Francis, has kept me on the straight and narrow all my life. And the people around me were the ones who allowed me the freedom to do the things that I shouldn't be doing.
Right.
And so I still had a bit of farming, and I have a few donkeys if you want to come out trot around the place out in Braindrome there.
What do you think then of the current kind of climate when it comes to farmers? You see a lot of protests going on at the moment, and they're trying to get rid of the kind of common farmer. Would you agree or disagree with that?
That was the case. You know, the ordinary farmer now, it's the farming has been subsidized. And that's the one biggest thing happened in this country economically. People had blamed the EU and everything. But when we joined the EU or the Common Market or EEC, it was in 72. After that, there was guaranteed prices for different things. We weren't dependent on the whims of one market, which, you know, we had some terrible periods where prices for cattle. So that's the upside of it. There's a lot of subsidies. There's a lot of stuff goes on in Europe. And we are, if you look at the geography of Ireland, you look at the proportion of Ireland that has arable land and land fit to feed cattle as well. We probably have a bigger percentage of arable land than any country in Europe, bar Poland. So that is an asset in Europe where you look to your assets. And there's a green agenda, obviously, about climate change. Mm-hmm. As the man says, we won't change the world, but we have to do our bit.
A lot of that comes down to, isn't it, the use of artificial nitrogen or something?
Yes, there is. And, right. And we have, our, I suppose, the area that we really can't cover up is that we, our water. Water quality in this country is, if that's a barometer of how we're behaving, it's not a good one. And I think that, you know, people say, oh, they blame him and Ryan, they blame everyone. We all want a good environment. We want a good economic position. We produce livestock in a very user-friendly way. To a good quality. And remember, if there's a big one problem that'll ruin the world, and that's hunger, and we are fit to feed. At the same time, we have to do it in an environmentally friendly way as possible.
So don't we export most of our beef though?
We do. We do. Well, there is certain things that aren't, you know, just don't add up either. We're not of importing too. There's areas there where
we could shift a bit.
Right, we could shift a bit. But certainly, and you can see if there's one thing about, we talk about our island, whether it's two countries or one country or whatever, our island has a shared interest economically. And if there's one thing will change minds across the country, it's the economic value of our farming, the economic value of the EU to us as a country. And North of Ireland is in a unique position. They have the UK, they are supporting them, and they have availability to the common, to the market, whatever the term is.
Because I saw there was for 2024, I think there's a projected increase in the price of a litre of milk and also in Finnish cattle.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
So things are obviously going to get a little harder.
There is. Well, inflation cannot hedge against it. You know, basically what's happening is money has been printed. The thing is that in the interim, you have to get it to the most vulnerable. And very often, maybe it goes to the most productive. And it's to have that balance right. Because since, you know, the value of currency, that's what inflation does. It reduces the value of currency. But the thing is, you must put people who need it in possession of it. And I think to a certain degree, and I say this against the party of I belong to myself, they certainly have loosened the purse strings the last 3 or 4 years. It would be unimaginable in a very conservative party going back the years to do that. And it's right that people are looked after, because you must, it's a rainy day for people now in certain circumstances, and they have to be kept above water, as it were, and when the good times come, that they're there.
Would that not, in a way, kind of be like when you have this notion of quantitative easing or printing of money,
yes,
as such, that then has the end being you're going to undoubtedly get high rates of inflation as a result of just printing money on demand?
It's the printing of money is really a correction. And it's building it up to a level that everyone can have some of it. I know long ago there was a fella called, the British done something like Wood's Halfpence. They flooded the country back in the 16 or 1700 with stuff that was valueless. Hitler did it at the end of the war, you know, with the Deutschmark. But it doesn't have a value in itself. But it's important to reach into your pocket, and you don't want to be looking for cryptocurrency, which won't really carry much of that. These are all mechanisms that I think it's the transfer over, and like we said about the millions and the billions, while you're crossing that great bridge, you want to make sure the people on the lower side of it are able to get.
Yeah, so. You mentioned there about cryptocurrency, which I'm very interested in. And one thing I do know about fiat currency, as we all do, is every single fiat currency there has been in the history of the world has always gone to zero. So I think the British pound is one of the longest standing ones. Obviously, we lost the pound and we went to the euro. And soon we're going to be going to, I think, a digital euro, the central bank digital currencies, which has its own set of problems. And again, when we talk about the printing of paper money, when it comes to printing digital money, it's going to be even more elastic in a way.
Yes.
So would you view cryptocurrency? Now, I'm not specifically talking about any one, but you probably have a notion of what the values of a cryptocurrency could be in terms of that it cannot be manipulated as such. Would you have any thoughts on...
I'd have to be honest about it. I don't understand. People have asked me about, should I invest in this, that and the other? And it's like, you know, there's 30 horses in the race, and how many of them are you going to bet on? The one that's going to win. And all the others are there to make sure that the fellow that wins will have a big purse.
Yeah.
These are all, to me, just vehicles. The euro, people blame the euro and they say whatever, oh, it's this, that and the other. But like when you had 2,000 lira to the pound, and you had every currency in Europe that you got, no matter what island you went, you had to pay, and they were all different. Now, the euro is a leveller, and even non-euro countries will accept it. It has taken status of the dollar or the British pound in terms of acceptability. As regards the glitches that occur, I think, you know, people say, oh God, I want to see cash and I want to feel the cash. But when I put my hand in my pocket now, I haven't any money of my own. I haven't been that way for a long time. But if I have a plastic card, I'm waving it. And I have to wave that if I want a ticket and if I want to get petrol. And I have some young girl, like the other day I was in Dublin at a funeral, and I says, what will I do here with this thing? And she says, hold on, I feel it. And she came round and she said, oh, press the button here and there to get your... You hadn't even to go into the filling station. You bought her. So these are at the end of the day, a lot will be made of the change. But they're all I've got a mechanism. And I think I said it to somebody recently, in 1932, Roosevelt came in after the crash. And what did he do? He printed, well, I was going near to say a billion, but we hadn't, billion wasn't in the language. He printed 20 million currency, and he pumped it into the US economy to get it going, you know. So it's whatever you want to call it, and then you value it against properties. And of course, if the more money, the value of that property automatically goes up. So they are mechanisms in themselves, as long as they serve the people. Like,
well, when Roosevelt came in 72, I think that was after Nixon had taken the dollar off the gold standard in 71. Which did lead to, again, this idea, well, it's not backed by anything physical, tangible now.
That's right.
So I think Roosevelt then coming in and saying, oh, let's get the print and press going.
That's right.
Again, it makes the money elastic, which I personally don't think...
The old problem is those of us who haven't got much of it have to extend it as well. So I suppose, but yeah, I know. Well, there are fears about things, and because we live in a world that isn't, we're not in control of it. Like, we're not in control of the information. It's illusory, a lot of it. But we sort of have to sleep in our beds at night, and we said that sure as it'll be all right in the morning when I get up, you know?
Yeah. A few kind of questions that I've written down here that I'd like to get answered from you. Who would have been the most influential person in your life? Put you on the spot.
I would say my mother was an influential person.
Yeah.
my life.
Yeah. Most mothers back in those days would have been, yes, I think, yes, you know, yes, strong figures.
Yes. Margaret Thatcher was only a shrinking violet and compared to the Irish mother. You know, and you see them on the, you've seen their statue on the Irish mammy, you know, and the old hand rocking the cradle does rule the world, really. But that, yeah, in fairness, yeah, my mother was, my father was a nice, easygoing man, enjoyed life. But he was, worked, he wasn't a slave, he worked hard. But my mother was, she'd want the when the turf would be cut, she'd have it saved, and she'd want the potatoes dug at a size speed, and she was an industrious type person. But yeah.
So she would have been the most influential, right?
Yeah, there's several people that say that to me, close enough to me, say, you're like your mother.
We've seen Boyle lose its economic stranglehold, if you like, over the last couple of decades. Do you think, yes, there's anything the town could do to recapture the glory days? Is there, in your view, something that could be done to get back those, the good old days?
Yeah, yes.
It's a strong that talking it point.
It is. It's, you know, Boyle in the 50s and 60s was probably one of the best inland towns in Ireland.
Two flas as well during the 60s.
It, yeah, there's a lot of, as the man says, there's a lot of sins out there. In 1944, when we won the All-Ireland the last time, there was four championship matches played in the Abbey Park. Four Connacht seniors, Leitrim and Sligo drew and replay. Roscommon and Sligo drew and replay.
Okay.
And it has been said to me, it may not be true, that we don't want any more of that kind of stuff and pestering the town with bicycles and clogging it up. In 56, 57, we had the ploughing championship out in McGivney's in, it was a technically, I think it was classified as County Sligo. Well, it is in County Sligo, but that was there in the town. We had the flay in 60 and 66, two very successful flays at the time. Possibly because they were further from Dublin, there wasn't any trouble. And like when you think of it, in 1966, there was £200,000 spent in Boyle. It would have bought the county of Roscommon. 70,000 people. And I'm only going as for my, I may be wrong on some of these things. In 1972, I believe we were offered, because of our good record, we were offered the flay on a full-time basis.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But we
and Innes, I think Innes took it at that stage. Now you can see how it has gone. There's been ups and downs in the flay over the, but like, it's a serious spigot like that. And I won't say Boyle is, and it's not any different. You take a town like Mohull, which was the big town in Leitrim before Carrick ever was. Mohull is a big town. A lot of businesses, a lot of those towns, the traditional shops, and we used to have it in the bank, Succession. And then trends changed. And Boyle was the same. You know, there was the place was full of big businesses and people talk about. That's a thing that has happened, and it has happened in every rural town. But you must remember that that happened in a situation where for 150 years, our population was in decline. And in 61 was the lowest census. And in 71, County Roscommon reached its lowest point, 10 years after others. So you had that slide, and that turn has come about. And I was saying to myself there, I was in Singapore one time, and Singapore is like County Sligo in shape now. It increased in size by 40% since 1960. The population of Ireland has increased by 40% in the same period. So you had that. So how we adapt to this change? We've had a lot of old recessions and disincentive for business and various things, and people went out of business, and then, but it happened in a lot of rural towns. The recovery, I think, is underway. Now, what about narrowing the Straits of Oil? I won't get into that. I wouldn't talk about it. I wouldn't dare mention it. I don't know what notion is it going to be. Helicopters will get through the town. But the hotel.
Yes.
So the town. Unreal. The Royal is done up. And Fair Joe's, and I want to make apologies for mentioning Frank Feehan. He got, it was 3 million, 4 million was got for it. And the building was recovered, and it's fine that it's recovered. But there should be some tourist element to that. It should be even a coffee shop or something.
Yes, and I know 100% agreed.
I was thinking, I don't know why I was thinking of coming over to you today. I said, you know, there's a facility there for festivals and different things like that. Maybe that, you know, that they'll only go on so many days, that if there was a coffee shop or something like that, because what you need is a sort of a, when visitors come, that they can sit down comfortably.
Yes.
And that's not to compete with other people in it.
But the Royal was obviously, as we know, the focal point of the town for generations. And it's a fine building now in Riga, but it's unused.
Yeah,
I think the only thing have at the moment is for art exhibitions, which has left a lot of bad taste in the mouths of people in the town, and you can understand that.
That's right.
So I do think, as you said, Tom, it should be used, whether it's a coffee shop or open the doors, make it accessible.
Aye. Keep it.
Yeah,
utilize it. There's that, and people say, "Oh well, what do you want a library for?" We you never reject investment. It's like the saying about the football matches, that. A library, a standalone library, is something that'll be there and for a century ahead. It free up King House space. It'll enhance our town. And you have to think then, okay, that's been negative. We see there, and I'm glad to see the Stewart family and their associates who are developing. And it's good that they called it, it's nice places are called what they were. St. Patrick's Keep. You know, that was the church from 1822, and it was the hall, and they're giving back the name it had. And that's good. And the development of that kind of thing. People, I think, bemoaned the fact that, and I'm saying things here, oh, I shouldn't be around it, but anyway, there was hotels mooted, and any one of them, we'd have been glad to see them at the time. We wanted them to be built on that, and it didn't happen. It probably would have been a fierce blow to the town. If you want to have a hotel in the town, bring it into the town, and then have others outside. And Kilronan Castle, great development. Like, I've seen that in ruins and visited and whatever. But there's so much Boyle still has. It has its river, and I don't know how the canal could have. I'm down there standing in a sway myself, but that canal should have come up to
further into town.
And maybe the river. But these are all issues. It's just we're all on the same side about Boyle. And I know there's a hotel planning for 21 Red, boutique hotel. That would be great. Something with hotel written on it would be a boost, because you walk 100 yards from the station and you can travel from any part of Ireland on public transport. Like Westport done it with the train, and long ago people used to get out tackle for the weekends. So Boyle still has a good name, and I think that recovery will come.
Just a matter of joining the dots, I think, and getting everything aligned.
Yeah.
But I know there's been a lot of negativity in relation to the planned library. But we had Kieran Sheeran on from the Boyle Town team on the podcast, and he was telling us that there was money there for a library and nothing else.
That's right.
So if we didn't take it, well, then some other town would get it.
Yes.
So it's a question of, do we take 5 million for a library and just a library, and because there was no money for anything else,
yeah,
or not? So I would agree that with your sentiment that we should take investment.
Yes.
Rather than just throw it away.
Oh, no, no, because that's the history. And it's no one to blame, you know. Like what made Boyle great was the business people in it, down the years. You know. And we came in from Boyle, we came in on the 8th of December, and Willie Taylor, the Lord to mercy him, and he had Santee, and he got in and Carrick, and came down, and the buzz, and there's people I meet everywhere. You know, yeah. They were in Boyle at some stage and had good memories of it. And it's just that we feel it greater and we say, oh, it's the terrible Boyle. Some of the finest commercial towns suffered that fate. And now we're on the up. Let's not be talk our country or our town down. It, and our young people are going abroad. And so they should. Because we're the most learned people in the world, in that we experience cultures and commerce across the world, and we've brought it back in spades. And that's why the foreign companies come here. So we're unlike most nations of our size.
One last question. What piece of advice would you give a 20-year-old Tom Mullaney, if you could? If you could go back in time and give yourself a piece of advice for the future, Tom, what would it be?
To have more sense, to say less, and to work more. But I won't say I did well, because doing well wasn't my ambition. I did a lot of things, and they weren't wise, and they weren't easy. Even coming here today, I was thinking about it. What am I, you know? And I'm sure what I have said, there'll be plenty of people fairly kicking them. They say that B-O-L-L, whatever. But our country is full of people like that. And if I know anything, it's because I've met smarter people than myself.
And listen, before we finish, Tom, is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to talk on or mention?
The old Rossies. I have two grandsons and I wish they could come back and play with the Rossies. I think the old GA and Roscommon is a big thing. We compete across the country well. Boyle Celtic do well. We had two good public representatives since 1999. John Cummins at local level and Frank Feehan at national level. And things have flowed to Boyle as a result of that. And tomorrow I meet a young woman, I haven't met her before, Tempna Daly Finn from Rigna. And she's setting out on a career, and I try and give her some help. So there's young people there, and it's important that Boyle has a voice. Anytime it had a voice, it was able to use it. And the only other one thing I think I'd mention of probably the most famous Boyle man of all was Paddy Perry in terms of sporting.
Oh, that's right. He had some crazy record, hadn't he?
He won 8 All-Ireland senior handball titles in the 1930s. And, of course, you book in that with Enda Smith.
Yes.
A very proud moment for our county and for his family.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Huge, huge achievement.
Yeah.
Huge achievement.
So.
Well, listen, Tom, thank you very much for taking the time. I really enjoyed that conversation. And thanks very much for coming on.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Carol.